Mother Earth. Thank you for all your abundant gifts. Good morning, Father Sun. Thank you for feeding all living things on Earth. Thank you, Plant Kingdom. Thank you, trees and plants, for converting the sun's light into edible foods that we can consume and digest, and for providing oxygen in the air that we breathe. Good morning, water. Thank you for being 75% of our body. We are one, and we bless you and protect you because we cannot live without you. Good morning, Animal Kingdom. Thank you for your companionship, your beauty and splendor, and for your sacrifice of life so that we may eat and live. Thank you, Great Spirit that moves in all things. Thank you for our lives and for the opportunity to be here and to be of service in this sacred earth garden of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Hello and welcome to Shaman's Keep. This is Caroline Wise King, your host. And each week now I've been talking to you a little bit about shamanism, about what it is and what it isn't. It is not a religion, but it is probably the most spiritual way to live life. Shamanism blesses a person's life with expanded vision and awareness. As we become more aware of every life form around us, we realize that we are all connected, all part of the same great spirit that moves in all things. Living with this sense of community, we are never alone, and we come to value the contributions of all our relations. And you know, when I speak of all our relations, I'm talking about the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, all the other life forms that make up this family of life on Garden Earth. It's good to have that community around you. It's a good way to live in awareness of all these life forms and their contribution and support to our lives. I want to help people wake up spiritually and to wake up physically as well, because we need to be aware of what is happening to our world. The earth is in dire straits at this time with contaminated waters and food sources that have been genetically altered. If we are to protect and preserve our beautiful earth for future generations, then each and every one of us must take part in making changes to the way we've been living and start taking into account the other life forms who share this planet with us. And toward that aim, I have some wonderful guests joining us today. I have Vincent and Claudia Pinto from southeastern Arizona. Vincent is a naturalist, wildlife biologist, and wilderness survival expert. Claudia is from the Andes, from Bogota, and she has traveled worldwide visiting countries in Europe and Asia, as well as Canada and the United States. And she's seen what's happening with preserving our resources in other countries. So she'll be joining us on that as well. Vincent, Claudia, I would welcome you to the show.
Thank you for having us. We're excited to be here and share our insights and hopefully pass on some knowledge.
Yes, good morning. I'm thrilled. Thank you for having us.
Oh, thank you both. I'm thrilled to have you on. And you have two nature preserves in southeastern Arizona, which you call Raven's Way Wild Journeys. You have a raven's nest, and what is the other one, Vincent? The one in the mountains?
In the foothills of the Chiricahua Mountains, right below Portal Peak, ranging from about 4,500 feet to 5,100 feet on a very steep and beautiful foothill right near the wilderness, we have Raven's Mountain. Everything is ravens with us. Obviously, ravens resonate with us as a symbol of nature and a symbol of our school as well. So between the two sanctuaries, we have about 100 acres protected.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you teach classes that range everything from Stone Age wilderness survival to sustainability and organic gardening. Tell us what led you to this path to do this kind of teaching.
Me personally, I'll speak for me and then Claudia can add her insights to her own journey. I've had a long journey. I grew up in Philadelphia. I'm 48 now, and I lived in Philadelphia for about 18 years until I moved away to college. During that time, I was fortunate enough to live in the northeast section of the city, where a part of Fairmount Park, one of the largest city parks in the United States, ran through the region. That area is called Pennypeck Park. It still exists today as about 1,600 acres of protected woodland and fields. And back then it was even more with all the unprotected kind of adjunct pieces that were connected to it. So really, I grew up with the woods in my backyard, despite growing up within the city limits. And during that time, as any kid would, we'd go out, we'd play and get muddy and get poison ivy and hop rocks in the creek and climb trees, etc. So unlike the concept of the last child in the woods, we really did get out there and interact with nature in a very natural way. And at that time, it was very, very far to downtown because in Philadelphia, at least, they didn't build over William Penn's hat as kind of an unspoken building code in the city. Now that's changed, and you can see downtown from that area, and many of the woods have been cut down. But I really attribute my first links to nature to having those woods to play in. I like to say to other people that I teach and guide that we're all born with a spark and a passion for nature within us. But if we don't nurture it, it could go away or be diminished or become so small we forget about it. Well, I fortunately was nurtured from a very early age. And despite not much encouragement directly from my family, I was lucky enough when I was a teenager to find a gentleman in those woods who lived near them and lived near me named Donald Link. And Don Link had already trod the path I wanted to tread and had a lot of wisdom, and I'll probably speak about him throughout the show today. But really, I think growing up near the woods is the short answer to that question.
Okay. Sounds very similar to Tom Brown Jr.'s background of growing up in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. I grew up on a farm in South Florida, and so I grew up living with plants and animals and trees. Trees were my best friends. We were miles away from town. And, of course, all the cattle and chickens and everything that we had on the farm. So, yeah, it gives you a sense of belonging to all of this great nature and the planet. Claudia, share a little bit about your background with us.
Actually, mine is very different. My background is in finance and international business. I was very privileged to go through the Wharton School of Business and Harvard, and I had traveled the world because of my jobs and basically doing international business and finance in these different countries. But throughout, I was feeling a sense of unhappiness. While it was very rewarding to be at the highest levels of corporate finance, personally, I always had a calling and a yearning to do something for the earth and for the preservation of the environment. So I lived in China and in Japan, and I was very appalled to live and work in places where growth always came at the expense of the environment. And in the business meetings that I attended, there was never any discussion at all as to the impact of our growth strategy on the natural resources around us. And that was always very frustrating to me until 6 years ago, when I was very fortunate to have a window of opportunity for a vacation, and I chose to come to Arizona. And I fell in love with the beauty of the land. And then I was fortunate enough to meet Vincent, who with his school really provided for me a wonderful opportunity to then now focus all my energies into the pursuit of trying to teach people and raise awareness about the unique biodiversity of the Sky Islands region where we live at the moment.
Well, it sounds like a match made in heaven and the Sky Islands. Vincent, would you describe a little bit about the Sky Island region? I had never been aware of it until I came across your website and started looking at that area. I never knew about the Sky Islands, and so many people may not have heard about it. Would you explain how all these biological regions have overlapped and there's such an explosion of life in all its majesty in that particular area?
Yes, we are probably one of the best kept natural history secrets and wildlife secrets in the United States, if not the world. You know, the Grand Canyon at the other end of the state, of course, and rightly so, gets a lot of press. we're kind of under the radar, which I guess is both good in terms of not being too overpopulated yet, but also a bit of a shame because, you know, we really have a wonderful place to visit and a wonderful place to reconnect with nature. The first way I connected with this place and learned about it was as a wild turkey researcher, as a wildlife biologist back in the late 80s. And at that time, I got to research wild turkeys in the Pellissippi Mountains. And I learned about how four main bioregions come together in this area. From the north, the Rocky Mountains come down and lend their diversity. So if you think of it, elk come near the area, beaver come near the area, trout, things that are northern, clarks, nutcrackers. So a lot of, you know, flora and fauna are more characteristic of there. In terms of plants, you could think, say, Engelmann spruce or white fir. From the south, you have the Sierra Madres, and they lend a bit of a tropical influence to the area. So we do have things like elegant trogons and jaguars and ocelots, which the northern part of the state doesn't have. When I say that to a lot of people, they're fairly surprised. Military macaws breed just south of the border, and really borders don't mean anything when you're speaking of this bioregion anyway. So you have the Rocky Mountains, Sierra Madre kind of coming together. And then from the east, you have the Chihuahuan Desert, kind of a higher, colder, but very rich desert. And then from the west, you have the Sonoran Desert coming in, all things considered one of the most diverse deserts in the world. So you have four bioregions meeting. You have a stepping stone sort of arrangement of very isolated mountains coming up from Sierra Madre and down from the Rocky Mountains, so that in terms of animal dispersal, you can kind of picture things that need more mesic or moist habitat connecting between these islands. And then the mountain ranges are very steep and isolated, so that things that need moister habitat, say a pine forest, do sometimes have difficulty going between one mountain range and another. And that even goes for birds sometimes. So rather than talking about, say, a real oceanic or a lake island or river island even that's isolated by water, here we're talking about steep mountain islands that are isolated by drier habitat, desert or grasslands in some cases, so that dispersal between them is possible, but it's also limited. And what that really leads to, along with the four bioregions coming together and the great elevation changes we have from about 2,000 to 10,000 feet, is you have a lot of different habitat zones inhabited in each different mountain range by a little different set of animals. So if you go, say, to the Chiricahua Mountains and make a perfect species list for birds, plants, mammals, reptiles, everything there can be there, and then compare that to the nearby Huachuca Mountains or the Pinaleno Mountains, all of which are close to each other, it's going to be quite different. So it's just amazing. We have so many different species crammed in together in such a small area, one of the most diverse sky island regions in the world. Now, when you think of all the different mountain ranges in the world, which are legion, in the whole wide world, there are only about 20 different sky island complexes, some of them tropical, and we are one of the most, if not the most diverse, all things considered. So we're really one in a million here. Very wonderful, very diverse, and very unique.
That is just amazing.
Very spectacular. Yeah, what's very spectacular also is that you would drive relatively very short distances, 2, 3, 4 hours in different directions, and you will encounter completely, completely different habitats. And for the most part, there is still a lot of land that is pristine and you know, untouched. So compared to so many other areas of the world, this provides really a very wonderful opportunity to interact with wild areas in their pristine form.
And well, I would have to add, too, if I can jump in. Sorry. I just wanted to add some of the spectacular numbers we have, in addition to some of the more emblematic individual species we have, say jaguars, elegant trogons type of thing. We have the most hummingbird species in the United States, 18 species. More bat species than any state except Texas, which kind of cheats because they're so big and dip so far south. We have 28. We have more ants than any place in the United States. In fact, just the Chiricahua Mountains have about 25% of all the ant species in the U.S. and Canada combined. Mm-hmm. We have more reptiles than any place in the U.S. We're renowned for our bird diversity. The plant diversity is off the charts. So it's really just an amazing area. No matter what you're into, you're going to have it in abundance here. It's really just a profusion of nature.
It sounds wonderful. And I'm just amazed that I had never even heard of that area before. What I would like to know is most of that area, is that under government, like park control, or is it protected somehow by law?
I'm really glad you asked that, Caroline, because it has some protection, but in our estimation, not nearly enough. And this is one of the, if not the main impetus for running Raven's Way Wild Journeys, which is to promote and protect the biodiversity of the Sky Islands. That's really the crux of our mission. And the answer to your question is that there's some protection. There are some national park units, say Chiricahua National Monument, Coronado National Memorial, but they're not very big normally. And then there is a larger protected set of areas in, say, National Forest Wilderness, usually surrounded by just plain national forest, not nearly as protected. There is some protected state land, some BLM land. It's really a mishmash of protection that amounts to, in our estimation, not enough protection. In fact, if you think about, say, nearby Organ Pipe National Monument, that has World Biosphere Preserve status, and we don't. And we're far more diverse, and we would have to argue far more beautiful than that area is, spectacular as it is in its own right. So really, you know, I think some of the border issues, unfortunately, we've heard, sometimes keep away that process and maybe derail it. But we do believe it needs a lot more protection than it has.
Well, I'm sure you're working on that. And this is something I don't think people realize, how much we have just devastated nature in our country with interstate highways going through, with all sorts of development that has taken up habitat, and so few places left where wildlife can actually flourish as they are in that area. And my focus on this program is to help people understand that we have to make some changes in the way we've been living, and we have to start taking into account what we do, how it affects the rest of the life forms. You know, Native American elders took into account all their actions for the next generation, seven generations, all their relations. It was in order to assure that future generations would inherit an abundant and beautiful world. In our modern day, where most people are living paycheck to paycheck and corporations are only concerned with bottom line profits, that concept seems to have been completely disregarded. Do you think it's possible that we might be able to turn this around?
You know, I'll talk first, and maybe Claudia can add her wisdom on this as well. I do believe we have a chance to turn things around, but if I was to use an analogy, we've left behind the ability to turn, say, like a canoe or a small vessel. We're more now like the Titanic, and trying to avoid the iceberg of environmental disaster ahead is no mean task. Basically, it's a very slow, and I think because the world is so complicated and intricate now, and there are so many of us, over 7 billion people, it's become a bit of a bear. It's become the Titanic in terms of turning things around, yet even something that large can turn around. You mentioned Tom Brown earlier. I think one of the best analogies he gave to me when I attended his class way back in the early 90s was that there'll be no real environmental change until, like, say, a flock of pet sandpipers or a school of fish. Everyone gets it and turns together, more or less.
Yes.
And I don't see that yet. I don't see that yet. I see people more all over the place, with some leaders saying, yes, hey, let's go this way, but a lot of people in denial. And so I don't know what sort of environmental disaster, hopefully not, or wisdom, or just chipping away at things piece by piece it will take to get that collective turning. But I believe that's what we need to do. I think it's still possible to make a big change. Otherwise, I wouldn't do what I do. I would just give up. But I'm not about to do that because I do think we'd make a difference.
Yes. Yes, that's my thought on it, too, because I think most people are aware of the 100th monkey story, and that is that some monkeys on several islands, on just one island, they taught them how to use a tool. And then once 100 of them learned how to use it, suddenly all the monkeys on all the other islands knew how to do it. So what we're hoping to do is affect the mass consciousness enough that we get that 100th monkey effect, that people suddenly wake up and say, wow, we need to be taking care of our forest and our and the other animals, and we need to understand how they all work together, because plants work together to grow in a region. And plants come to us sometimes when they know we need them. On my last show, I mentioned how people with asthma sometimes will have this plant called Mormon tea show up in their front yard, and they don't know what it is, and they pull it out, and they're, oh, get that weed out of my yard. But that plant helps people with asthma. If they make a tea with it, it helps them to breathe better. And the plant actually comes to people that need it. And so there is an interconnectedness that we have completely lost a sense of, that that a communication that actually is going on between all of us, although most humans have blocked it out, like, you know, as if it doesn't exist. But we are all one. We are all part of everything. So everything we do has a ripple effect. What changes would you suggest that people begin to make in their own lives to help restore the balance in nature?
You know, I think there are a lot of things people can do. It's, of course, a very broad statement, because each person is an individual, each family is different. However, I do believe there are some things that if we did it in common, it would make a collective difference. At the very least, we should start, say, with our resource use and, say, the three R's. When people say, hey, you know, I reduce, reuse, recycle, to me anymore, that's like saying, well, I eat, breathe, and sleep. That should be the bare minimum we do. I like what one book I read recently said, which is consider the fourth and fifth R's, rethink and refuse. In other words, stop buying stuff. So do you need it? And if the answer is no, that's a good thing often. Okay? So that's a start right there. I would also say to anyone who has any sort of land, and I'm talking 10 square feet or even a flower pot to Ted Turner and everyone in between, which is we can all make a difference with the land. We have a lot of humans on the earth. And while that's also our main challenge, I think, in terms of resource use and depletion, it's also one of our best assets. So when I see a bunch of weed whackers and leaf blowers and plant material being thrown out like garbage, I think, wow, how can we be using this stuff? For instance,
compost.
When we pull non-native plants here at Raven's Nest, we recycle it to help restore hydrology in our arroyos or washes. We use it as mulch in our organic gardens. We have planted a plethora of native species here, trees, vines, shrubs, wildflowers to benefit the native plants. Or sorry, native wildlife. So, you know, there's a difference you can make with every action that you do. How, you have to ask this question, how am I going to benefit or hurt the earth with every action that I do? Because very few of our actions are neutral.
Yes.
Not only
yes,
that, but I think as people and as communities, I think we really have to rethink the use of natural resources. I think people are very unaware that we are going to be facing shortages of water, shortages of food, and that's why we are so keen on empowering people as to how to do rainwater harvesting, how to plant their own gardens, how to really honor the land and do composting and be more self-sufficient. And we do regular open houses to showcase our model of sustainable living practices that we have here at Raven's Nest, our 42-acre nature preserve. So I think if we individually were to take more proactive action, and as communities, we were to rally together and share those, you know, products of our gardens and our knowledge as to how to do rainwater harvesting and so forth, would be much more empowering at a local level. That has to come from us, because having been part of big corporations in senior management positions, I know that the change is certainly not coming from the corporations. This has to be a bottom-up approach, and it has to be individuals and communities that become more resilient, more self-sufficient, and really models of how to better use the resources and honor the land.
Absolutely. Are you aware that there are two states and a county in Oregon now that have outlawed collecting rainwater on a person's land? They've actually made it a criminal act that can be charged and you know, punishment dealt out about it. just for collecting rainwater. And I'm like, my goodness, that's a permaculture is all about conserving the water and using it in a beneficial way for growing vegetables and all. And even the rain that falls down, we can't collect that. How do you see this working out? I mean, my fear is that other states will also enact laws against collecting rainwater.
Well, you know, that's a very good question and very scary. We had looked for land way back before we got Raven's Nest here in 2008. We had looked in New Mexico, and that may be one of the states you're referring to, where it's very complicated water issues. And indeed, they very much regulate what happens. And it's kind of, I think it's personally ironic on a political and human level that the same people, I would have to say maybe people who lean very right and are very conservative tend to have much bigger families, and the earth is very overpopulated, yet they're the same people who cry, too much government, too much government. Well, hey, wake up. If we have too many people, there's going to be more government. They're going to regulate you more, and you're just going to keep complaining about it. So, you know, one of the main things we've done, we've chosen quite actively, and one of the things we share in common is we've never had children. I'm personally adopted, so we believe in that. So, you know, it's very important, we think, to address the population issue. And while we don't do that in our classes, we're not going to bury our heads in the sand and pretend that every single issue, environmental issue upon the earth, goes through the population issue. It's magnified by it. So, you know, we do live in a world where we're adding people. And as I read recently and agree with wholeheartedly, you know, we're going to need about a whole nother planet worth of resources by about 2050. Based upon projected population growth and also, you know, the amount of resources we use per person. And when people, you know, roll their eyes and say, well, hey, that's India and China, I'm like, you know, I don't know how many people you and I account for in another country, but it's not one. It's many in terms of resource use.
Mm-hmm.
So we all need to look in the mirror and we all need to say, hey, this is a dire situation. What are we going to do like tomorrow, like yesterday, basically? You know, it's getting to be too late. We better do it now.
Yes. We're at the edge of... Go ahead, Claudia.
Regarding the rainwater harvesting issue in Arizona, we have water shortages and people that have basically their wells gone dry. So here, so far at least, it is encouraged. And, you know, I am surprised to hear about what you mentioned in Colorado, but hopefully the trend will be on the opposite direction, encouraging people and giving them tax breaks if they are proactively in states like ours that suffers of a drought most of the year, that people proactively do what it takes to collect the water on an active and a passive basis to then benefit, you know, their gardens, their edibles, and, you know, as we do here, the wildlife ponds that ultimately benefit wildlife.
Right. Yes, it's, well, actually, it's Colorado and Utah. Now, I understand Utah is a desert state pretty much, but Colorado has ample rain and snow runoff and a lot of water. Those two states, though, do not allow you to collect your rainwater, and this one county in Oregon. So it's kind of scary, as you said, Vincent, because so many people, and I'm urging everyone to start growing your own food because so much has been genetically altered, or it's being brought in from countries that are using the very insecticides and herbicides and all that we banned being used in this country. So a lot of our truck farms are it seems like we're bringing in more and more vegetables from China and other areas. And like I said, they are using the very things we banned here. So what what have we accomplished by banning it here? Or why are we buying from China our vegetables, you know? But a lot of people are beginning to grow. I'm growing tomatoes and herbs on my patio. And a lot of our listeners I know are in the city. And they are, you know, they don't have a yard large enough or with a situation where they could actually grow their own food without perhaps a greenhouse. But I am urging more and more people to begin to grow something, some of your edible food. Begin to connect again with where your food is coming from. Yeah, what do you think, Vincent?
You know, I think that's a huge point. I've gone through my own evolution with this whole issue. When I was very young, of course, I didn't think about it much. Food just showed up in the supermarket.
Right.
And I think that very juvenile, and understandably juvenile when you're very young, attitude has spilled over, unfortunately, to a lot of adults. A lot of adults now think, or you know, that food just shows up in the supermarkets and that's it. They don't really think about where it comes from and all the issues you just mentioned and more. So, yes, we very much encourage people to grow their own food. We have organic gardens and organic orchard. And perhaps more importantly in the long run, or equally as importantly, we do have 42 acres where we encourage the wild edible plants, be it prickly pear fruit or roots from obscure plants that people don't even know the names of anymore. You know, when you think about it, back in hunter-gatherer times, everything people got was not agriculture. It was not bought. It was from the land, and nothing was tilled. Now, I'm not saying we can all go live back that way. We don't have enough people. You know, we have too many people. We don't have enough land. But by the same token, as we reconnect to the land, one of the basic things that we teach people here at Raven's Way Wild Journeys is to reconnect with the plants in particular. Why? Because they can provide you with a plethora of uses. If it's not food, then it's medicine. If it's not medicine, it's shelter. So when you think of, say, people in a city, which is more and more the dilemma people find themselves in, the situation that they find themselves in, I think of community gardens. I think of, say, the country of England, where with very limited space, they're starting to take lawns on hospitals and things like that and replant them into gardens for food. So, you know, we're going to need to rethink. The days of leaf blowers and lawns are very short-lived, I think. They're not long for this earth.
Yes, I'm an advocate of gardens in place of lawns because we have to get back to reality. You know, having just a pretty green lawn, what does that actually do for you? We have to begin to live with purpose and take it, you know, take advantage of what the earth is offering us. Now, I love your philosophy that each species is an incredible gift and blessing from Mother Earth, and that it deserves our attention and respect. Explain a little bit about how each plant's role in keeping the nature, the balance in nature, how each plant is so important, the biodiversity that we seem to be losing with our cities and parking lots and highways and everything. Each plant has a purpose. Would you explain a little bit about the importance of biodiversity?
Yeah, you know, biodiversity in general means, of course, the number of different species you have in an area and the number of individuals within each species. That's the basic definition of biodiversity. Now, if you look at the basic biodiversity of any one area, a lot of that's going to evolve through the plants. There are very few communities on Earth, mostly just deep sea vents, where there are no plants, you know, anchoring the communities, if you will. And also, you know, from a natural history and connecting with nature standpoint, I go outside with my students and point out, look around, what are you seeing? Okay, a few birds, maybe a lot of insects sometimes, but you're always seeing mostly 99% plants. They have a lot to tell you. There's a lot of beauty there. So on a very primal level, you get fulfillment through the beauty there. On a biological level, you start the food chains there. And on a personal level, when we first got to Raven's Nest Nature Sanctuary, which again is 42 acres, there were some healthy areas, but there were a lot of very hammered areas previously by cows, by some of the previous owners who had horses, weed whacking crews, just lack of TLC. So we said, you know, we can't just say, hey, let's take the horses out, the weed whackers out, and the cows out of the equation. The laissez-faire attitude of biodiversity in plants doesn't work anymore. We need to come in and revitalize the biodiversity by removing the non-native plants, such as the different various non-native grasses from Africa here, like Lehman lovegrass and Bermuda grass, and instead put in the native trees, the native shrubs that, mind you, grow within about 50 to 100 miles and about 500 feet up or down in elevation from where we live. In other words, they're very, very close to exactly where we live, and many of them grow right on our property already. And what we've seen is a cascade of that diversity from the plants we put in the ground to the insects that come eat them. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, my God, insects are eating what we planted. That's not good. No, it's great. because then the birds come to eat that, and then the predators of the birds come, etc. So really, you have to start from the bottom up in the food chain, and that means plants. So when you think about it, we think about the not only the biodiversity of the plants themselves, but the structural diversity. Well, we're not in the redwoods here. We don't have, say, 200 to 300 foot tall trees. We do have different layers, down from a mossy layer, even sometimes, and lichens on the ground, up through grasses and herbaceous plants, through subshrubs, shrubs, small trees, and larger trees. And those layers matter hugely. For instance, one of the previous owners had trimmed up all the velvet mesquite trees around here to look, quote-unquote, like proper trees. Well, that was terrible for nesting birds, for instance. So, you know, what nature wants to do, we're just trying to help it along.
Well, that's certainly true. Last week I was in Colorado, and I had the chance to go foraging up in the high mountain area there. It was 9,000 feet. I couldn't breathe. I'm not used to that elevation. But I was astounded at how many edible plants and medicinal plants were just everywhere under those trees. I mean, there were wild strawberries, wild roses with rose hips on them. There was yarrow and plantain, and everywhere you looked, there were plants that were either edible or medicinal. And I'm like, my God, we have lost all of this with our bulldozing and putting in planned developments and cities, and then everyone wants one out of maybe 20 trees that everybody likes to have in their yard in that city, and all we have is lawns, a particular grass, a particular tree. We have just almost destroyed diversity of plants in any of our cities. But on the mountain, yes, where it's actually wild and untouched, oh my God, it's like the Garden of Eden. Everything was there. All these edible, wonderful plants and all these medicinal plants, everything you needed. It's just like Genesis says that a plant was put there for every need you might have. And we have just forgotten. We've come so far away from the Garden of Eden concept. And go ahead, Vincent.
I was going to say, sorry to jump on the bandwagon, when you think about it, every bioregion on Earth where there was a culture very evidently had everything that culture needed. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been there. And yet, I think, I want to say a Western attitude, I wouldn't say European, but maybe a Western attitude or a more modern attitude, is that, you know, we need to come in and improve nature. We need exactly what you said, to put in a handful of things that we find attractive. We need to make it exotic. Well, I'll tell you, being from Philadelphia and having moved to Arizona long ago, to me, this is exotic. And when I go to any place, it's exotic, it's beautiful, it's perfect the way it is, as long as we haven't messed it up. So when I think in terms of biodiversity, I think we need to keep all the components, as Aldo Leopold, the great writer and wildlife biologist, would say. You know, when you're tinkering with nature, you better tinker carefully, because if you lose a part, you may need that part later. And we're losing parts left and right. So when I do think of the plants out there, every plant I see, I know, has a gift to me. Now, whether that gift is just beauty, you know, because it may not have a human use yet, or whether it's a medicine, a food, a shelter, a tool. I'm writing a book on useful plants of the Sky Islands, an ethnobotany, and I already I have about 25 different categories of plant uses, and I know I can expand upon that. So, you know, it's absurd for me and for Claudia to think, and I'm sure yourself too, that people can go out and not know a single native plant, yet know all the jingles to commercials on TV. I mean, we're wasting our brain cells away. Our brains want to absorb a lot of information, but boy, we're putting in the wrong information. It should be about plants and animals and the environment, because we're losing our heritage very quickly.
Exactly.
And what we're trying to do at Raven's Way Wild Journeys is precisely that, is to bring people who normally are in the cities or in apartments and completely addicted to computer and all these gadgets and all these technological things that are happening at the moment and to be and that are normally wired, to bring them away from that into a setting mm-hmm. where they learn and understand, hey, how is it that I can live off the land? How is it that I can understand what the different plants are useful for? How can I make fire by friction or shelter? Which ones can I use as edible or medicinal for medicinal uses? And it's to try to remind people that the land is, the earth is very generous and it provides you with all these gifts only if you take care of it, if you nurture it, if you preserve mm-hmm. it, and if you know how to use it accordingly. So especially here in this Thai Island region where there are still a lot of wild areas, it is our daily mission to try to raise awareness particularly of that. It's like, hey, don't go over building and destroying these habitats with a bulldozer. Please bring mm-hmm. Vincent in and understand all the resources you have right there in your land before you go destroying it to build a garage or to build some sort of unnecessary structure. Try to understand how communities around here rely solely on the gifts of the land, and they thrived and they were extremely successful. So it is to raise that awareness that we find, you know, very compelling as our daily mission.
Yes. It's just, I don't know, our way of thinking has become so separated from nature that people are so caught up with technology and they're so busy with their cell phones, texting and on their computers. And, you know, all of this is wonderful. But if it breaks our connection with our source, our support system, which is the earth and the waters and the sun and the rain, if it breaks our connection, then we are lost. And this is why I'm so thrilled about the school, that you're teaching everything. You're teaching everything from Stone Age survival, which people need to know now. A lot of people are scared about all the doomsday issues with 2012 and what if the power grid goes down or what if this happens or that happens. And they don't know how to take care of themselves out in the wild without modern equipment. I know you teach classes in that, and also you teach organic gardening and sustainability, but you have two different areas that you teach in, which is good for me. You have a high desert area, which teaches desert survival, and then you have a mountain area. And I would like you to describe more of the class kind of classes that you teach, because people really need this information now.
Definitely. We couldn't agree more. And when we tell people about us, we say, you know, Ravensway Wild Journeys, it's not a business. It's not an organization. No, it is both of those things. It's a passion. It's a lifestyle, and it's a legacy, because we're here mm-hmm. and gone on this earth very quickly, and we want to leave in our footprints good things. We want to leave mm-hmm. teachings and learnings about the earth. So when we think about the common thread to all our classes, because we do cast quite a wide net trying to bring in different people through different concepts, that the unifying concepts are biodiversity and sustainability. So, for instance, mm-hmm. we love to take people out on nature adventures. We know people need to be excited. We just don't want to give them nuts and bolts, for instance. We want to get them moving through the wilderness. And we do at least two levels of that. One is a nature trek, where we get people moving at, say, a normal to fast pace through the wilderness, so you can explore a lot of ground. You get some physical fitness out of it, which is a great thing in this day and age of obesity and mm-hmm. such in the United States. Mm-hmm. So our nature treks go far afield, deep into the wilderness. And our naturalist saunters, that's a different speed, a la Thoreau, let's say, where you meander through the wilderness, taking a close look at everything around you from a naturalist standpoint. Of course, we mm-hmm. do bird watching, and we do wildlife safaris, a la Africa, that type of thing. Tracking, ethnobotany, astronomy are all adventures that we do out in nature. Now, when we talk about planetary survival, of course, we do earth stewardship programs. And in light of that, we have organic gardens that supply quite a bit of our food. We also glean food from the land in a sustainable fashion. So we teach wild edible plants. We have the organic orchards. And then we sustainably harvest water from the land. Fortunately, not outlawed here yet. I think we'd fight that tooth and nail. And we have two 10,000-gallon tanks, so 20,000-gallon capacity of active rainwater harvesting. And at least as important, we passively harvest a lot of the rainwater that comes down with berms and swales. So there's a there's a lot of, say, Earth stewardship going on there. Then when I think of personal and planetary survival together, I do think, say, Stone Age skills and wilderness survival skills. How absurd it is that you can take your average city person today, and there'd be some exceptions, of course, and put them in the wilderness, and they're soon going to falter, even if it will be a very easy situation to live in or to get out of or both. It's the same thing.
Yes, they panic.
Panic. It's the same thing as if I took, say, a Paleolithic person from anywhere in the world and stuck them in the middle of New York City. They might quickly get run over by a car, and we'd say, well, why didn't they know that red light meant stop? Well, do we want to be that absurd person in the wilderness? Do we want to be that ignorant person? How lost we are to have come that far from our roots. So, you know, we're not proposing that people go, you know, they live in caves or live in huts that they build, but to know how to survive is to know nature, and in knowing nature, you'll love it, and in loving it, you'll want to protect it. And everyone should have those skills. A new paradigm, say, for education should be that people should come to places like us, take a year or two off and take classes, and then go back into the educational system, perhaps, as a necessity right now. But, you know, you get some real-world experiences. You have, say, a rite of passage as a young man or a young woman becoming a full man and a full woman. These are things we're lacking. And with our classes, you know, be it survival, be it, say, even say, thorns, stingers, and fangs, welcome to Arizona. That's another class we teach. Don't be afraid of nature. Don't be afraid of nature. Yes. Be leery of technology. Doesn't mean put technology down the toilet. It means be leery of it and use it as a tool, okay? And, yes, when you talk about, say, the grid going down, we're not doomsdayers. We never teach really survival from, hey, this will help get you through the disaster. Though people come and learn from us for that reason, what we say is, of course the grid's going to go down eventually. Okay, everything fails eventually, and that eventually could be soon. What do we know? But I'll tell you this, we're putting a lot of our eggs in one basket, and when that basket gets too heavy, the bottom's going to fall through, and God knows what's going to happen at that point. So learn the skills, learn them because it gets you close to nature. But they're going to be pretty useful when things happen.
Yes.
And learn the skills because the skills empower you, especially for us women. I think there is this preconceived notion, very erroneous, mind you, that for us women, unless there is a man with us in the wilderness, we are unable to tent camp and we are unable to survive. And I think that is one of the main reasons why I got involved, because my background is in finance, is corporate. I was a city person in Europe and in Asia. And so clearly you would think someone like me will not adapt. Well, I've thrived, and I've spent as long as a week by myself, thanks to all the skills and the teachings that Vincent has given me, and I have felt the most empowered and the most independent and the most self-reliant ever, knowing that on my own, no matter what comes my way, I will be able to take care of myself. So for us women, I think it is a wonderful set of skills to have as well.
Absolutely. Like Vincent, I took the survival class with Tom Brown back in the late 90s, actually, and it was so empowering to learn how to make fire with two sticks, you know, and with a bow drill. And it was so empowering to know how to, what plants to go to get the fibers to make cordage. You don't realize how important it is to make cordage and rope and have a way to bundle things together. And, you know, I from that class, I felt like, okay, as long as I have a knife, I can survive anywhere. And, of course, even without a knife, I can make a knife out of a rock. So these are things people need to know.
I think so. I really think the word keeps coming up, but it's true. It is empowering to be able to go out and feel like a competent human being. I'm going to bring up my friend Don Link, who I had mentioned earlier in the Pennypack region of Philadelphia. Well, he was about 40 years older than I, and he's since passed on. But he basically told me, Vince, and he told me this in my late teenage years, early 20s, live the question. And as a fairly intelligent young man, I was like, okay, live the question. I maybe kind of sort of got it. Then it dawned upon me what the pertinent question in my life, and I think in everyone's life should be, which is, what is it to be human? And to me, it's not sitting in front of a computer all day or TV or in a box, as they say, going from one box to another, one that transports you, one that houses you. It's interacting with life. Nature is not a destination that we go to. Nature is life. So when we have this idea of going to parks and other destinations where nature is, no, nature is where you're at, and you need to let it flourish there, and that's what we help people realize and do, is to interact with life and to live that question. I may never have an answer, but I have candidates for answers, and part of the candidates for answers are connecting with nature and realizing I need, in a hands-on, interactive way, use all my senses in the natural world. I think that's primal. I think that's why our classes really help people connect to a sensory awareness and primal level.
Yes, well, because no matter how people might feel about animals, we are part of the animal kingdom. And it is natural for us to be out in the woods and out around plants and among nature.
Exactly.
That's who we are.
When I think about the absurdity that here are some glorified apes riding around in cars, I'm like, are we really doing this? whereas I look at us walking around in nature, it's like, well, that's natural. That feels right. It feels right to, you know, hey, if there's a mountain lion or bear around, feel the hair stand up on the back of your neck. We're on the menu too, and that's okay sometimes. But they're the same people who are afraid to go in nature will drive 90 miles an hour. And statistically speaking, that and your bathtub and your neighbor's dog are a lot more dangerous than anything you're going to find in nature.
Absolutely. I've come to the conclusion that our species must have come from living on sterile spaceships or something. They don't want dirt. Oh, you're tracking dirt into the house. Oh, that's dirty. Oh, that's scary. Oh, that's, you know, it's like nature has become the alien world instead of the natural world for us.
And especially for these younger generations where you see so many things being virtual and kids thinking that it is normal to sit in front of a computer and experience a virtual nature activity. That's why we feel so strongly about bringing school groups, university groups, people of all ages, but particularly the young, because they have to get out, get dirty, get into nature, experience what it is to be with ants, to be with insects, to see butterflies, etc., so that it is a real experience and not a virtual experience via a game or some sort of computer gadget.
Right. Claudia, I'm going to have to interrupt. We're running out of time here. I do want people to know how to reach you. It's ravens-waywildjourneys.com. And
Our website is ravensnatureschool.com. Punctuation. Ravensnatureschool.com.
Okay, excellent. I want them to know how to reach you. This is such valuable information. I hope you'll join me again at some time in the future on this program. And I want to thank you both. This has been wonderful. For all of our listeners, stay tuned next week. I'm going to talk a little more about shamanism. And until then, may the sun kiss your face, may the waters bless your body, and may all nature sing in your presence. Have a wonderful week. Thank you.